It's Monday, July 20th, 2026, and you're listening to Abounding Grace Radio with Pastor Chris Gordon. Today we have a special. We're continuing our short series on the end times, taken from a recent live event we had called Israel and the Antichrist, with co-host Reverend Dr. Dan Borfin and special guest Reverend Dr. Kim Riddlebarger. Dr. Riddlebarger is a former White Horse Inn co-host and author of A Case for Amillennialism. In part two of this first segment, Riddlebarger connects the current wave of end times speculation to the events of October 7th in the Israel-Iran conflict, as well as setting the stage for the conversation around topics such as Israel, dispensationalism, replacement theology, and more. Without further ado, let's start today's show, Israel and the Antichrist, Segment 1, Part 2.
Is there a future for the nation of Israel, a geopolitical one possibly? They could be horrifically pushed into the sea and it wouldn't change the promise.
Right.
Lord willing, I hope that never happens. I think Israel's a great ally and I think it's significant that they're there. I'm glad they're there. But I think God has a purpose for the Jews, and I think it would be a great capstone to redemptive history to, at the time of the end, those ancient people of the Lord's come in great numbers back to their Messiah.
But if something happened to the nation of Israel, we wouldn't have to change our eschatology.
No, not a bit. And some folks will say, well, Kim, your position is essentially dispensationalism. You're arguing the land promise is everlasting. Not the land promise, the covenant promise. Land promises, however long in the providence of God, Israel exists. But whenever you talk to someone who is dispensational, mainstream five-soul evangelical, the thing they're going to say, and the pink elephant in the room is, Israel's back in the land. What do you do with that? Mm-hmm. And my response is, in the providence of God, it's back in the land. I don't know. The scripture doesn't tell me why.
Yeah. Let me just read Romans 11, that passage, beginning verse 25. Lest you be wise in your own sight, I do not want you to be unaware of this mystery, brothers. A partial hardening has come upon Israel until the fullness of the Gentiles has come in. And in this way, all Israel will be saved. All means all. We hear that a lot from our Armenian friends. All Israel will be saved, as it is written. The deliverer will come from Zion. He will banish ungodliness from Jacob. And this will be my covenant with them when I take away their sins. So, right, there is disagreement in the Reform camp. Some take it as ethnic Jews will be saved, a great influx of ethnic Jews coming into the kingdom probably before the end. Or is Paul speaking of the spiritual offspring of Abraham, mm-hmm. the church?
I think the logic of the position that, say, Lee Irons or Opal Robertson take, that this refers to the full number of the elect, logically makes perfect sense. I think Christ will return the last elect believer comes to faith. I don't think that's the question Paul is asking and answering in Romans 9 to 11. I think he's dealing with the question, what's going to happen to Israel? And so I think your point stands that all Israel, if Paul uses that phrase consistently back in Romans 9:6, 9:5, 9:6, he speaks of not all Israel is Israel. So right. He's using it the same way in Romans 11:25, 26 as he does. And I think that makes a lot of sense given Paul's consistency. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I think, especially with what he's dealing with right at the beginning of Romans 9, have the promises of God failed?
No.
That's the big driving question, it seems to me, of those three chapters, because that's what the dispensationalist says to us all the time, right? So we're expecting the reconstituting of them and the land and these things, and Paul's answering it there. It's amazing how much Romans 11 particularly emphasizes that at the present time, what's happening.
Mm-hmm.
And Paul himself is an example of that.
He's an example. He's a believing Jew. He's part of the elect remnant according to grace, mm-hmm. he says. Yeah,
yeah, remnant according to the election of grace.
And we should say this was a dominant position in the Reformation, that the Jews would come to Christ. And this, you know, many people love to attack Luther for one of his later works, Against the Jews and Their Lies, when he kind of goes off on a screed.
Oh, Martin.
Yeah.
Please don't do that.
Not his best moment.
Is it early or late, Martin?
Well, that's very late. Yeah. Many Luther scholars will say there's evidence he had kind of an onset of dementia at that point, so he's not in his sound mind when he's writing this. So.
Well, he's also angry. The gospel had been recovered and restored, and the Jews didn't believe it.
That's where I was going.
His eschatology expected that to be the case.
Exactly. You look early in Luther, he has so much expectation that now they will come to faith.
Yeah.
And he wanted that, of course.
And
so when it doesn't happen, then he gets angry and writes against them.
And of course, Martin Luther did not have an unspoken thought.
Right.
Which is the danger of having theological students sit with you at dinner.
No filter.
There's no filter, and they hear all the family talk, and then they write it down. And we have it later.
We get this charge made against Reformed people that you're replacement theologists. I remember talking with David Hawking one time. Yeah. I wonder if he's the one that coined that. I don't know. Do you know who coined that
I
phrase?
Don't know who coined it. It's the same with amillennialism. We don't know who first used the term.
I think it's David
guesses, but
I'm convinced it's Hawking. Yeah. Anyways, so are you a replacement theologist, Kim? Is that what you are? What is that? And help people, because that's the charge often made.
That's the charge.
And it's still daily made against Reformed people.
It is. For one thing, there is no single reform writer who identifies themselves as a replacement theology, a replacement theologian. So it's a charge made by those who haven't read our stuff, who don't understand our stuff. It's a label you can throw on your opponent. Mm-hmm. We were talking about labels earlier, Tucker calling Trump the Antichrist. It's a sin the reform people do. We call anything we don't like Arminian. Or if we want to include something that's kind of questionable, we call it covenantal, and everybody goes, oh, it's all right, it's covenantal. So it's a term like that that dispensationalists will throw on us. Look, the church began in Genesis 3:15. Christ is the true Israel. So those Jews who believe in Christ are in the true Israel. Christians are in the true Israel. So the idea that the church replaces Israel just is nothing we teach or believe. What the church does is continue that covenant of grace, only now the membership changes from Jews plus a few Gentiles, like the Ninevites who believed, and I forget which group of ites converts, but you know that whole story. And then once Christ comes and the Messianic mission begins, gazillions of Gentiles now are added to that people of God. So it's not replacement theology, it's expansion theology.
Yes.
So I think, in fairness to dispensations, it's because they don't read our stuff like they should, and it's a lesson to us to be careful to read their stuff if we're going to criticize them. I think it's one of those cases of just sloppiness.
And ironically, their tactic is right out of Saul Alinsky's Rules for Radicals, and accuse your opponent of what you're guilty of.
MacArthur did it.
The dispensationalist is the true replacement theologian, because God's program in their system is first with Israel, national Israel. Christ comes, he offers the kingdom to Israel, they reject it. So then what does he do? He turns to the Gentiles. He replaces national Israel with the Gentiles for the church age.
Yeah.
And then in the tribulation, it's back to Israel again.
Great point.
The replacement theologians, not us, but they accuse us of that.
Great point.
Yeah. And I think he goes on to make this point in Romans 15. For I tell you that Christ became a servant, this is verse 8, to the circumcised to show God's truthfulness in order to confirm the promises given to the patriarchs, and in order that the Gentiles might glorify God for his mercy. And one of the verses he quotes there, Psalm 117, which is amazing psalm in the Jewish Psalter.
It is.
Right? You know, and there it is. Praise the Lord, all you Gentiles.
The one passage that really stumbled me when I was a dispensationalist, I went to Westminster Seminary as a dispensationalist, and Dr. Godfrey and Dr. Johnson were so patient with me. I didn't understand a word Meredith Klein said at the time. I just am kicking myself that I couldn't take those classes now. But Ephesians 2:11-22 was the death knell, because there we're told the whole purpose of Christ's Messianic mission is to take the two peoples and make them one. So there's no sense when Gentiles replace Israel. It's rather in this new covenant, God's going to take these two groups, Jews and Gentiles, and make them into a new humanity. And it doesn't switch from church to Israel. It's taking two people, making them one in Christ. And those passages just wouldn't be in the New Testament if the church replaced Israel.
And that was always the plan from the very beginning. Yep. Like you said, the church begins in Genesis 3:15. It wasn't that he switched his mission to the Gentiles. It's all the Gentiles were always included in the plan. So instead of replacement theology, we really have an expansionist theology.
Yep.
And fulfillment.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
I always like to emphasize the fulfillment of the promises too. In you, Abraham, all the Gentiles, all the nations of the earth will be blessed. It was always in the plan.
Right.
So, I think also, was it 1 Peter 2? That's also one that comes to mind, where he emphasizes, where is it? Where he says, you are the holy priesthood, the holy nation.
Yeah.
He's applying all the promises there to the people
Verse
of God.
9.
Yeah.
You are a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people for his own possession, that you may proclaim the excellencies of him who called you out of darkness into his marvelous light.
Yeah.
Well, whenever I teach and lecture on this in public, I get two questions. One is, how can you say the devil's bound? And the other is, are you a replacement theologian? And I think
there are stupid questions, apparently.
Well, I think if your pastor has said that, if your favorite YouTuber has said that, if you follow John MacArthur, and MacArthur says that, you're just going to parrot that. And I think it's a lesson to all of us to be good students and not just merely echo what we've heard.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, MacArthur on the chain, he said it's a real chain around the devil's.
Yeah.
So, anyways, maybe go over some of the, just for some who still struggle with I'm just amazed. Do you think, Kim, that dispensationalism, it seems to me that the eschatologies of the times are often dictated by the political environments that we're in. Do you agree with that?
Oh, absolutely. I remember, I'm, of course, a conservative who loves Ronald Reagan, and I remember the rise of theonomy during the Reagan years and following, because there was a sense of recovery of national pride, and
it's mourning in America.
It's mourning in America. Yeah, exactly. And Reagan had a grandfatherly quality about him that no president since has had. And you get the sense then that people are going to have a so-called optimistic eschatology when the outlook is better. So if you are very happy with MAGA and think MAGA will continue on forever, you're going to be seduced toward post-millennialism because of the expectation, the utopian expectation, things will get better. And so you're hoping that the geopolitical thing will bear that sort of fruit. And I think that's a bad mistake to make, because you're not doing it exegetically. Mm-hmm. You're looking at the times and saying, things could get really bad really quickly. Just take a look, for example, at the national debt. Mm-hmm. Those of us past retirement age are learning that Social Security may not be around in 5, 6, 7, 8 years. What's that going to do to the climate of American life? You're going to have some really angry folks. Where's your millennial kingdom? Mm-hmm. Well, of course, we're all geezers, so we're not going to be able to riot in the streets, but we'll have our walkers out and block roads and sidewalks and stuff. But, I mean, you tie your wagon to cultural things, and while it's improving, it's getting better. And when it stops improving, we go to war. You know, I've expressed the opinion that, you know, what could happen that would change things? Well, we could have an economic disaster, or we lose a war. Those two things change the culture irreparably in a negative way. So if you hit your wagon to cultural stuff, you're going to be unprepared when things go bad.
And just going back to the rise of dispensationalism and the organization of national Israel, you look at the late 19th century, dispensationalism coming on the scene in a big way, as Zionism is also coming on the scene in a big way into the 20th century, 1920s after World War I, and England is more involved in Palestine, and that's when dispensationalism hits another level, the establishment of Dallas Theological Seminary. Post-World War II, 1948, the organization of the Nation of Israel, the foundation, 1950s, 1960s, that's when dispensationalism really takes over, becomes the dominant eschatological view in American evangelicalism. So they're tied hand in hand.
They're tied hand in hand. And don't forget, the wild card in all this is Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Because if the world has the bomb, there's always the threat we can destroy ourselves. And that gives eschatological time and hope for a second coming a whole new meaning. Hope it's quick, because I don't want to, you know. So
Not to mention the advent of new technologies, which always get labeled as the mark of the beast. Whether it's the magnetic strip on the back of your credit card that Pat Robertson called the mark of the beast in the 1970s.
Yeah. So Chuck Smith.
And then later they were taking donations from credit cards from the mark of the beast to their ministries.
I feel sorry for the poor guy that got a Social Security card with 666 on it.
And now it's AI, of course. AI is the new mark of the beast. So, but surely in a few years, they'll be using AI to take donations for these ministries with AI.
The rise of postmillennialism, though, is curious to me. So where do you think dispensationalism is today? That's my first question. It seems to me it's kind of a dying view. But then I look at what's going on in foreign policy. It's holding out, obviously. But then you have the rise of postmillennialism in a time that I don't think is very optimistic. Yeah. That's what's confusing to me. So it seems to swing, pendulum swing. I mean, 10 years ago, everyone was seemed to be woke, and now that pendulum has the pendulum has swung. Now everyone, you know, we've got a bunch of people who are anti-Semitic, and we got a bunch of hate and anger. It seems to me that some of the new postmillennialism thinks this is the last moment to grab hard.
A couple things there that need to be unpacked that I think are really great issues to discuss. One is Charles Hummel in his book, Rise and Fall of Dispensationalism, which is the definitive history of dispensationalism. If you're interested in that topic, that book's a must read. He makes a distinction between what he calls scholastic dispensationalism, which is just a bad title because scholasticism is a history outside that tradition that word doesn't fit. So call it scholarly dispensationalism. These are the guys at Dallas Seminary that had PhDs in Old Testament, New Testament, could read Greek and Hebrew, were really first-rate scholars.
Charles Ryrie, John Walbert.
Yeah, we're just wrong guys about eschatology, but really godly men and concerned about evangelism and so on. Even nothing can say negative except their eschatology. Then you've got what Hummel calls pop dispensationalism. These are the guys who have the uncanny ability to tie current events to an obscure Bible verse. And so they can tell you what Ezekiel's wheels within wheels is all about, and they can find something on the news that ties into that.
Just Jack Van Impe.
Jack Van Impe.
His daily broadcast with a newspaper in one hand, finding fulfilled prophecy every single day. It's uncanny. Yeah.
So, that was your pastor.
So there's that, and I think dispensationalism is really on the wane. I like I say, I go back to my youth. My dispensational teachers could defend it from the Bible and do it well. The current crop is really struggling from the fact that mainstream evangelicalism has kind of given up its dispensational leanings for much more covenantal scholarly kind of stuff. I call them five soul evangelicals, Wheaton and places like that, where they're pretty kindred in a lot of ways. So dispensationalism is living off the fumes in the vase and is, has less to say, the academic form. But the pop stuff will always be with us because, as we said, if you can get on YouTube, if you can form a podcast, if you can tweet, you're going to have a following. Mm-hmm. And those guys are going to be with us anytime there's a current event. I got a big kick out of several years ago when Damascus fell to the Syrian forces and kicked ISIS out. All of a sudden, an obscure prophecy in Isaiah about the fall of Damascus was raised as though it were, this is predicted. It had to do with the Assyrians, for Pete's sake. It's been fulfilled for 2,700 years. Give me a break. So they have an uncanny ability to do that. That keeps it going. Postmillennialism is a whole different bird because when you talk about postmillennialism, you have to define what you mean. There are three kinds. One is the secular utopian postmillennialism. You know, John Lennon's Imagine. It has a long history in American culture. You know, the Chicago World's Fair in the 1800s that had trained that laid its own track. You know, you had all kind of, we could do anything kind of thing. So that tradition went into the social gospel. Things are really getting better, and if they're not, we're going to make them get better. You've got that whole secularized thing. Then you have a form of postmillennialism that I would describe as evangelical postmillennialism. This would be the postmillennialism of old Princeton. The Scottish Presbyterians, the Free Church of Scotland guys, they really did believe that the gospel would go to the ends of the earth and convert mass numbers of people before the Lord returns. I have no bone to pick with those guys at all.
And they worked toward that end, and sending missionaries to the ends of the earth.
Through missions and evangelism. It's we're going to send missionaries to the ends of the earth and see people get saved. That's wonderful. They taught that cultural transformation was incidental to the missionary enterprise. The missionary enterprise came first, and if culture was transformed, wonderful, because it probably will be. I have no bones to pick with those guys at all. Then we have, thanks in part to Greg Bahnsen, we have a theonomic form of postmillennialism which dominates today that argues that the nations are going to ask the question, by what standard will we govern ourselves? It's going to be the Old Testament theocracy. That opens the door to all kinds of bad stuff. One thing, it obliterates the law-gospel distinction. And it shouldn't come as a surprise that those guys who lean that way or have Wilson, the rest of them, are always having trouble defining justification because where does that fit in all of this? Then you get this rise of Christian nationalism, which is tough because patriotism is a Christian virtue. We should all love our country, be willing to put on a uniform to defend it. That's not Christian nationalism. Christian nationalism is a theocratic state. So you think you have problems with your worship committee? What do you do with Congress? Are we going to put the Apostles' Creed and the Ten Commandments and in the Declaration of the Constitution as Wilson wants?
Well, that's what cracks me up. These, especially the ones in the Reformed world in NAPARC, where we have 650,000 people in all of NAPARC and over 1 billion Roman Catholics. If they were successful, who do you think is going to win that? If Christian nationalism wins,
it won't be Reformed people.
It's not going to be us.
No. Now that I'm retired, I can say this and not get in too much trouble.
We're not that attractive, by the way.
I love our guys, but you go to Synod and you think, these guys are great churchmen, but I don't want them running Buena Park or Anaheim. And neither do they want to do that. And you start to talk about Reformed people in positions of power. Mm-hmm. Get your passport ready.
Yeah.
It's a scary thought.
And look at church history. Anytime Reformed people have been in charge of the civil magistrate, we wreck the place.
And we do.
We should be underdogs. We're not on top.
We're much better out of power.
Yes.
And being good citizens that we are in power, making everybody else be good citizens.
We're the fly in the ointment.
The whole New Testament militates against
exactly.
this. I mean, and that's why the Christian nationalism discussion, the way that it's gone. I mean, I had Wilson on the program, 3-hour discussion, and that was something else, by the way. But he, that's the question I asked him. Who do you think would be able and competent to run the nation?
Ted Cruz.
And you can see the behavior. You mentioned anger earlier. You've got a lot of young men really angry right now because the nation is not made promises, not paying out the way they think it should pay out. It's a hard way of life. They can't buy a house. They got all these things. So they think that the answer is Christianizing the nation,
right,
and imposing the law of God back on the peoples to correct all these problems.
The law does its work. I wouldn't have known what coveting was if the law not said do not covet. Those of us who are around evangelical legalism knows how poisonous it is. Mm-hmm. The minute you start having the blue law kind of things, the first thing that happens is you start looking at your neighbor thinking, I wonder what they're doing. It breeds a pharisaicalism on the one hand. On the other hand, there's going to be the poor person in our pew that's looking around going, I can't measure up to that guy. I can't measure up to that guy. I don't measure up. Maybe the Lord doesn't love me. Maybe I'm not of the elect. It just snuffs out faith. So you have those kinds of issues. And then we're right back to the are we going to govern according to the theocratic state in Israel? That's still the question. And Calvin and others have said, no, it was great for theocratic Israel because it brought us a Messiah, it brought us the scriptures and so on. But outside of that purpose, that is not the way to govern, and we go by natural law. God bless David Van Drunen.
It was always intended to be temporary.
Always intended.
Yeah. Even Kuyper said that.
And Kuyper too, yeah.
Kuyper said we break with the imperfect position of the reformers on these issues.
Exactly.
Which is, I don't think people realize he said that. Yeah. So, fascinating.
Kuyper was Prime Minister of Holland, and Bobink retired as a minister to run for politics. So, if I recall something.
Well, that's all the time we have for you today. We thank you for joining us here on Abounding Grace Radio with Pastor Chris Gordon. We hope you'll join us tomorrow as we continue this short series on the end times. Until then, God bless.